From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the singer who Ray Charles said had soul way back when people weren't using the word, we feature an interview with Jimmy Scott, and we have a review of his new CD, Mood Indigo. Also, teaching mindfulness on the basketball court, a talk with coach Phil Jackson, who just led the LA Lakers to the championship. Before joining the Lakers, Jackson coached the Bulls to 6 NBA championships. And our guest film critic, Henry Sheehan, reviews the new Farrelly Brothers comedy, Me, Myself, and Irene, starring Jim Carrey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with jazz singer Jimmy Scott. But first, Kevin Whitehead has a review of Scott's new CD. Jimmy Scott made his name with Lionel Hampton in 1950, singing the ballad Everybody's Somebody's Fool. As a solo artist, he recorded for a variety of labels through the 50s and 60s, then gradually fell into obscurity until he was rediscovered in the early 1990s. David Lynch used him on the soundtrack to the film Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, and he recorded some high-profile records featuring pop songs for Warner Brothers. His new CD is a more straight-ahead jazz program. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, this time, Scott's really in his element.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see. Blue birds singing their song, nothing but blue birds all day long. Never saw the sun shining so bright.
That's by far the fastest number on Jimmy Scott's new CD. And even there, he tugs against the beat to make the tempo seem slower. Most of the time, for Scott, dead slow is full speed ahead. It's like he lives in the cracks between the beats and the spaces between syllables. He'll stretch out a word the way Henry James extends a sentence.
Imagination. It's funny, it makes a clouded day sunny, makes a bee think of honey, just as I think of you. Imagination is crazy. Your whole perspective gets hazy. Starts you asking her, Daisy, what to do.
Jimmy Scott's attempt to make time stand still is a metaphor for one thing that makes him special. He inherited Kallmann's syndrome, which prevents the onset of puberty and the change of voice and spurt of growth that go with it. For a long time, he was known as Little Jimmy Scott. That condition gives this 50-year veteran of show business the voice of a world-weary boy. An air of freakishness hovers over his art. Not for nothing did David Lynch have him sing the immortal Sycamore Trees in that Twin Peaks movie. But Scott has carefully honed his instincts for selling a song on the installment plan. When his voice cracks or he wavers on a long note, the high drama he brings to the slow burn is no kid stuff. He's always on the brink of going too far, but too experienced to let that happen.
The journey to be where you are. How long is the journey? Cry party is the ocean. How high is the sky?
Jimmy Scott is a riveting live performer, as anyone knows who's seen him, in a moment of ecstasy, throw his arms wide and shoot his shirt sleeves 14 inches out his tuxedo cuffs. His new CD, Mood Indigo, which is on Milestone, is closer to the spirit of his live sets than some pop-oriented records he made in the 90s. His road band, The Jazz Expressions, plays on a couple of tracks, but mostly he's surrounded by name guests, including pianist Cyrus Chestnut, alto saxophonist Hank Crawford, and guitarist Joe Beck. The Toots Thielemans clone on harmonica is Gregoire Marais. But it really doesn't matter so much who backs up Jimmy Scott. When he has a spotlight, he commands your attention so completely, the band just melts away.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Mood Indigo, the new CD by singer Jimmy Scott. I spoke to Jimmy Scott in 1992 at the beginning of his comeback, following a long period during which he rarely performed, and when he did, it was likely to be at a CD bar. Here's the title track of his comeback record, All the Way.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you. All the way. Happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way. Taller. To go deeper than the deep blue sea. That's how deep it goes. If it's real, when somebody needs you.
When you started singing, were there a lot of listeners who assumed you were a woman?
Yes. Yes. I had people play the records after doing them with Lionel Hampton. And they'd have contests on the programs to have the public tell them who it was. And many people called women's names. And finally, it was announced that it was not a woman, but it was myself whom was singing with Lionel Hampton at the time. And then I've even had people in the public question, is he really a guy, or is that a woman standing there, you know? So those things have happened, you know. But being in the business, you learn early in the business that opinions are not supposed to affect the work you do in public, you know.
Nevertheless, though, how self-conscious were you when people assumed that you were a woman? Were you self-conscious about the pitch of your voice?
Not really. There were times I could say later in the career that I wished that my voice would be deeper for materials that I might have wanted to select to do. But that's the style of my voice. There's nothing I could do about the height of my voice. And so I learned to deal with it.
I want to play one of your early records. Mm-hmm. This is from 1955. This is your first session for Savoy. And this song is Don't Cry Baby. Mm-hmm. And Bud Johnson's on tenor saxophone. Charles Mingus is on bass. Let's hear it. This is a great recording from 1955. Jimmy Scott. Something I read about this session was that Mingus, who was featured on bass, walked out during the session. What happened?
Well, you know, one of the things, of all guys, to be confused about a singer singing behind the beat, it was quite surprising to know that he was affected by my style of singing. Because I do have a delayed behind the beat, you know, expression when I sing a song. And that was one of the things. He just couldn't cope with it. This guy ain't singing on time. It's, you know, what are we doing here? You know, and he was a very strict, arrogant guy about that, you know.
My guest is Jimmy Scott. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
You ain't been blue, no, no, no.
Let's get back to our 1992 interview with Jimmy Scott. Some of the people who were influenced a lot by your singing style include Nancy Wilson and Frankie Lyman. Did you hear yourself in them when they started to record? Did you notice the influence?
Well, you know, it was mentioned to me. I didn't pay specific attention to what it was like, or but it was related to me by others. Oh, man, Nancy sings that song just like you would have sang it. Or Frankie Valli, he's using those high notes just like you would do them, or something like that, you know. When I began, I realized through our relationship or our association, but I've told this often, and it's true, I came up in the business when artists, like vocalists, shared a lot of music with each other. Therefore, I could understand that we could pick up things from each other. And, of course, Nancy's was surprising because her parents have often told me how when they would bring the records I'd do home, she would get herself and lock herself in a room and just listen over and over and over.
One of your big breaks was in 1948 when Lionel Hampton asked you to sing with the band. And after he hired you, Hampton changed your age from 25 to 17. Why did he do that?
I don't know whether you remember, but a Sugar Child Robinson.
Right. He was a dancer,
pianist,
wasn't he?
Yeah, a little pianist and a boogie-woogie player. This little kid used to play boogie-woogie in the piano. He was out of Detroit, out of the Michigan area. And Hamp had picked him up. Well, he had done great with Sugar Child. He had toured him all over, and he was quite successful with it. Well, he was into a thing of giving young persons opportunities. I looked young, and by looking young, he wanted that young appearance on stage. And I think that that's really the gimmick that was being used, you know?
Well, how'd you feel about that?
Well, it didn't work too well with me. Because, all right, okay, I'm a grown man, you know? So I couldn't develop an attitude of childhood as far as being in the public, you know? And it didn't work.
Well, also, I can imagine, you know, a lot of 25, you want to meet women, too, and if you're...
Well, see, one thing about it, I had the first wife.
Oh, you were married already.
I was married already, you know. And we were separated, but I was married, really. That means I was dating women, you know.
Right.
And how could you go around dating women and the public see you with women and whatnot, and they say, oh, that kid? Because I had many people tell me, get out of a bar, because they thought I was a kid, you know?
How tall were you then?
I was about 4'11". Yeah, about 4'11".
So that must have made it even more difficult.
Yes, because I didn't start to growing the size I am now until, I was darn near 40 years old.
That's really unusual, isn't
it? Yes, yeah. But that was a glandular and a hormonal deficiency that caused that, the syndrome thing that caused that. And then when it did react, then I started growing.
Were you taking any kind of hormonal pills when you started to grow?
No.
So it's just like your hormonal balance changed?
Yes. It was just like a delayed thing, you know?
So how tall are you now?
I'd say 5'10". Say 5'8", really. Yeah, about 5'8".
Now, when you were undergoing this hormonal change, it didn't affect your voice at all?
Not at all.
Were you glad that it didn't affect your voice?
Afterwards, yes. After I realized just what was happening, I said, well, thank God. It didn't affect, but now it did make it stronger. I project stronger. If you notice the old records, they're much lighter, vocally much lighter in sound than the records that I'm doing today.
Now, how is your new record affecting your career? Are you performing more now?
Yes, I see more prospects for performing. Now, I'll say that. And I have been doing... I'm doing more the kind of dates that I'd like to do.
Not playing seedy bars, playing
right.
Classy
places.
I mean,
before it was a necessity to work. Okay? Now this enables... and makes it possible for me to do less of that type thing. Of course, I had strayed from it anyway. I had gotten to the point where, hey, if I gotta go in one of the dives to do a gig, no good. And I began working for small organizations and doing concerts and things like that for them in their promotions and things. When they wanted fundraisers and things like that, then I started performing for little organizations. That worked out well because that left the performance to be more or less like a concert style. You know?
What's the worst part about performing in a dive?
Well, most of it is that the people there are not really conscious of the music that you're trying to portray. They're there for the drink and a hell of a good time, and they ignore completely what's going on where the entertainment is concerned. So that begins to get awkward with you, you know, when you go out there and you do have a purpose to your work. Okay? All right, if I was a rock and roll singer or a noise maker as far as my performance, it wouldn't matter, I'm sure. Because that's what they'd called for. But seeing the dives and things, hey.
Did you ever feel like you would never record again, that you had made your last record?
No. No, I never felt like that it would be the end. I know I've been, I've had statements made, who in the heck wants to hear a 60-year-old singer? That statement was made, it was heartening, you know, because you say, well, hey, why should a guy feel like that about it? But then, I mean, the answer was there. They're listening to Frank Sinatra. They're listening to Tony Bennett. They can listen to Jimmy Scott, too.
Jimmy Scott, recorded in 1992. Let's hear a track from his new CD, Mood Indigo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
There will be many other nights like this, and I'll be standing here with someone new.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide at www.alcatel.com. From eTapestry.com, creator of web-based fundraising software for managing the donor information of large, medium, and small nonprofits, eTapestry.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up from the archives, an interview about coaching with Phil Jackson. He just led the LA Lakers to the NBA championship. Also, a review of the Farrelly Brothers' new movie, Me, Myself, and Irene, starring Jim Carrey. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Monday, Coach Phil Jackson led the LA Lakers to their first NBA championship in 12 years. It was Jackson's first year with the Lakers after leading the Chicago Bulls to 6 championships. Over the years, he's coached such top players as Michael Jordan, Dennis Rodman, and Shaquille O'Neal. I spoke with Jackson in 1996 after the publication of his book, Sacred Hoops, in which he described his style of coaching, which includes meditation and other principles he's learned studying Zen Buddhism. Zen is about transcending the ego, whereas star athletes are often known for their inflated egos. We talked about how Jackson deals with that paradox. Do you ever say, go meditate and realize that you're more important than your ego, that you must put your ego in? You know, I mean, do you tell them, do you try to use the principles that you follow of meditation and Zen Buddhism to try to get them to just get rid of some of that ego.
There's no doubt that we try to teach them the tool, you know. I think it's real important that, you know, you carry some of your belief to the marketplace with you when you go out there. And that's something that you can't sit on or hide. So, you know, I have a professional person that comes in that I really respect that can come in and teach what we call mindfulness or focusing without using the term meditation because it may carry some weight to the term. And we talk about its values that to play, its values to relieving stress, and we talk about how we can do it. We practice it as a group, and but we, you know, it's not something we daily come to practice and sit on our cushions and meditate. You know, this is something that I think is where you open the door, or maybe give them the key and say, "Here, it's yours to use if you want to use it." Because that's as far as I want to go as a coach. I don't want to, you know, be forceful or controlling, but, you know, allow that freedom. But there's other things. You know, we'd like to teach, you know, we'd like to teach yoga. We'd like to have, you know, a Tai Chi instructor. You know, I mean, there's other things that we'd like to have, but when you only have so much time, we think that being focused, mindful, is maybe one of the most important things that you can, you know, we can teach or can give them as a tool. So that's one of the things we talk about. Then we sit down, and when we're going to do something that requires this mindfulness that's incorporated in our work, then we can talk about it as a group. How connected are we so that we have mindful behavior, or that we're really, you know, working from an awareness level. As to how we perform or what kind of level we're performing at under stress, even in very games of great magnitude. So it's a tool that is used not only for a personal level, but it's also used at a level to help make the team a better team, I think. So that's why I've incorporated.
You said that you've tried to get players to connect with something larger than themselves. How do you do that?
Well, I do it in, you know, whatever way is, you know, a cause that's greater than, say, well, let's win the NBA championship. We want to, you know, we want to win the NBA championship, and we want to have a great contract, and we want to have material goods bestowed upon us. Those are things that are all, you know, so ephemeral material that, to me, it's got to be something that's bigger than that. And it's every year I just think of different challenges. You know, last year, you know, we had kind of this motto that the journey is the reward. That the reality of working day by day, practice, if it's a practice day, game, if it's a game day, and the journey of doing this thing day in and day out is in itself the reward, and it was, because we won, you know, 72 games last season, which was an incredible feat for a team that plays 82 game schedule, to do that day in and day out.
Do you have a sense of how much of your success comes from this approach to coaching, where you're applying certain spiritual principles and so on? How much of your success comes from that, and how much of it is just much more practical things about calling plays and analyzing strengths and weaknesses?
Well, you know, I'm trying to paraphrase Yogi Berra's comment about, you know, 90% of it's mental and the other half of it's physical, or something like that.
Right.
Well, 90% of it's mental and the other 50% of it's physical. The reality is that you've got to have the athletes and the players that can do this. There's no substitute for the talent, and that you have to have talented people. Yeah. The jollies that I get from, you know, doing this spiritual or goal-seeking than a higher level is just, I tell them, you're just appeasing your coach and you're letting me have my fun, so that they have an idea that they're letting me have some fun while they're doing the game playing. They get all the fun playing the games. I get some fun playing mind games.
You know, professional sports is so much about money and power and, of course, winning. And those are things that don't seem that compatible with Zen Buddhism and meditation and spiritual values and so on. How do you deal? I mean, when you lose, how do you deal with that? And because why is winning very important if you're trying to be in a more spiritual plane that's not about ego and so on? How do you correlate all of that in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of times we come in and we win what we call win ugly. And I don't like to use that phrase. It's just that we didn't do as good a job as we perhaps could do. And there's still lessons to be learned, but we always think there are a lot
that,
of
that means you won, but you made real blunders even though you won?
Yes, it wasn't a pleasing game. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to play a game at a level in which people will remember how we play basketball. That's one of the goals that I say that, you know, it's one of these type of things that let's have something beyond just, hey, we won, and that's it. Let's do it in a style or a way that's remarkable, that's, you know, inspiring to people, because we have that ability, we should play at that level. And there's some games that you come in and you lose, and you feel pretty good about losing. It was still a great battle, it was still a wonderful night, and you can still benefit from something that you've had that hasn't been a win. And there's some nights a win may feel just as bad as a loss. And so we don't always say that it's measured by wins and losses, but it's measured by how you play.
Did you always feel that way?
No, I don't think so. I think winning was the all-important driving motivation for me as a younger person.
And when did that change? Why did that change?
It changed somewhere in my professional career. Professional ball became a continuation of a very long season of 82 games. And I came to a basketball club that was struggling and suddenly became very good in the New York Knicks for a 7-year period of time. And during that period of time, the enjoyability of winning and the focus on how to do that became more important than just on winning, as it was when I was a rookie and this was the Knicks were a struggling team. And if you could just win a game, it was the most important thing that you could do.
What are your pep talks like before games?
Well, first of all, they're very low-keyed, and they're not pep talks. I wouldn't put them in those. It's a matter of bringing to focus what the group has to focus on. And so it may be on energy. It may be on developing enough energy for the game, but more or less it's on, you know, what we can do that strengthens us as opposed to what we can do that can take away from the opponent's ability to operate at full strength. And so it's just trying to bring key points out to a group. I have the oldest team, they tell me, in the NBA, average age over, you know, 30. And they have probably heard every pep talk possible by the time they're 25.
Mm-hmm.
And so pep talks are usually going to leave them deflated. And, you know, they bring their own energy to it. So what we'd like to do is bring focus. A lot of times it's just a moment of quietness, and sometimes it's a 2 or 3 minutes. So let's just be still and quiet before this game and get ourselves thinking on one as a one-man unit or a one team, have a mind of one. So just so that we can get in stride together, because it's been disjointed, we may have a hard travel schedule, the media may have been busting their seams to try and get into our locker room and have stayed too long, and we just need to focus. But for the most part, the players that are the premier players have great focusing ability, great concentration skills, and to bring everybody to that level is always important.
When you were playing with the Knicks, what worked for you best before a game, and what were some of the things your coach, Red Holtzman, would do?
Well, Red was very constant. He used to say almost the same thing before every game, and his speeches were probably at most 2 to 3 minutes. And at some point during the talk, he'd usually say, if you guys have any trouble concentrating, just nod your head so at least I think that you're focusing on what I'm saying. Or if you have to prop your eyelids open with toothpicks, don't mind me. I'll watch you do it. You know, and he would joke about it himself that he was saying the same thing. But what he was trying to do was trying to get us in the same kind of focused mood and concentrating on the same activity. For me, what worked best of all was to stretch and to be quiet before a ball game. That was the things that I enjoyed doing.
We're listening to a 1996 interview with Coach Phil Jackson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with Coach Phil Jackson. He just led the L.A. Lakers to their first championship in 12 years. It was his first season with the Lakers after leading the Chicago Bulls to 6 NBA championships. How were you first introduced to Zen Buddhism, and how did you start incorporating that into the game?
Well, I had a brother that was a college student, graduate student, and he picked me up at a baseball game I was playing in North Dakota. I was a senior in high school, and drove me from Bismarck, North Dakota, back to Williston. And in that very late night drive was telling me about some very exciting things that was that were happening in his life, and among them were the introduction to Zen Buddhism. It kind of opened my mind to a new format. I was raised a fundamentalist Christian. In the process, I started searching a little bit on my own, and you know, ended up as religion as one of my minors. I had a composite major, actually. One of my majors in college was religion. And I kept exploring until really I kind of found a group that I could sit with in the early 70s.
And that connected to the game for you right away, or did it take a while?
Well, it really did. I was disconnected from the game. Actually, you know, it was so opposed, athletics was so opposed to my spiritual life that it was kind of a schizophrenic life for me. I could play sports over here in the very world, or I could be over here wholly in the very spiritual world, in church and in the community that I was born and raised in. And the two supposedly didn't meet. And as a consequence, I think that's one of the reasons I loved athletics so much, was to get away from all this religion. And then the process of finding out that, you know, really it goes with you everywhere. When I was a little bit older, I could realize that, you know, this was something that you carry with you. You don't have to carry it on your shoulder as a chip, but you can carry it in your heart.
Your father was a minister. What were your parents' reactions to you pursuing sports professionally?
Well, my mother was a high school basketball player.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, she was a high school basketball player and a letter winner, and I often wore a sweater when I was a little kid, you know. And she liked to come out and shoot hoops, and there was some a great competitive level that she had. And so basketball was really kind of an accepted format in our family as a game, although I liked all the sports of football and baseball, too. But it, as long as it didn't interfere with church, it was okay. And we had Friday night meetings in our church, and my brother, who was an older athlete, 6 years older than I was not allowed to participate in athletics because they had Friday night games in the high school basketball team. So that was a real conflict. When we moved to a new church in out of the state of Montana to the state of North Dakota, they didn't have those Friday night services. They had Wednesday and Thursday night church services to go along with their Sunday services. And so the Friday and Saturday ball games did not interfere, and it was okay. And so I was fortunate.
Did you ever go wild after leaving the more regimented life of your parents?
No. I don't think in that regard, never went wild. I did explore and was, I think, a person that liked to try different experiences, but I'm not one that went wild.
I want to paraphrase something that Dennis Rodman says in his best-selling book. He says, you know, in the NBA, off the court, 50% of life is sex and the other 50% is money. How do you deal with it, watching some of your players get really caught up in that off-the-court life of sex and money? You come from a much more, like, from a very disciplined background, and you're very disciplined as a coach as well. You have a spiritual side to help you and to fall back on. So what do you take a part in their private lives off the court, the part that might have to do with sex and money?
Well, you know, that's right there. That's a level sometimes of some of the people that, you know, have to live in this world of athletics. It is, and most people assume that that's really where athletics lives at, that level, but that's not so. I think athletics lives at all those levels, from the conscious to the, you know, the very mundane and the very earthy areas of our psyche. And, you know, from this standpoint, I'm able to do some things that are kind of fun with the team. You know, there's this kind of a collection of people that know that I give books out to the ball players. And we have a long road trip at the early part of the season. After usually a weekend of the year in November, we usually take off on a road trip for 2 weeks. Covers Thanksgiving. And during this period of time, I give them books in which, you know, I make a little attempt to try and, you know, move them along on this path, you know. And one of the things I picked up from one of my teammates, Senator Bill Bradley, was that, you know, there's people want to move up. People want to be more conscious. And, you know, just from my association with him and, you know, maybe going to art museums here, some things that, you know, I wasn't really associated with when I was a young man, and learning, you know, some kind of things that were culture or taste oriented, I found myself intrigued by them. And I feel that other players, and professional players particularly, want to improve their life. They want to be educated. They go to college. A lot of them don't get through college. Some of them still want that education even when they come to the NBA. And I like to help push that along or move that in a direction they like to go.
Could you mention any of the books that you've given out?
Well, you know, one of the players Zen, I gave Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance to was John Paxson, one of our great players in the past. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, I gave Beavis and Butthead to, you know, Stacey King, who loves cartoons and loves television.
Have you had to deal with players who grew up poor and now have big money and don't necessarily know how to handle it?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, that's quite obvious that the younger players in our league, regardless, you know, have never had this kind of money, and no one would. Regardless of whether you've grown up in an affluent family or not, suddenly have $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $1 million at your disposal is, you know, ridiculous to think about. So there's a process that goes through the NBA of young players come out of college, and the first year they buy their toys, and the second year they buy their cars, and the third year they're doing other things with their money. And it usually takes a 2 or 3 year period of time for these players to realize that all the material growth and wealth and everything else that they have has not brought them any happiness. It's brought them diversion, it's brought them some, you know, comfort, but it really hasn't brought them the kind of happiness. And they're starting to get back and think about the fact that, hey, you know, this is a career, I better be a professional, and all this has just made me want maybe to explore life a little bit deeper.
Phil Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry. I've listened to so many programs. It's really been a pleasure to be part of one.
Phil Jackson recorded in 1996 after the publication of his book Sacred Hoops. He just led the LA Lakers to their first NBA championship in 12 years. Coming up, a review of the Farrelly Brothers' new movie, Me, Myself, and Irene. This is Fresh Air. Jim Carrey suffers from a split personality disorder in the new comedy Me, Myself, and Irene, directed and co-written by Peter and Bobby Farrelly, the team that also made the hit There's Something About Mary. Carrey starred in the Farrelly's first hit, the 1994 film Dumb and Dumber. Guest film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Me, Myself, and Irene is bound to go down as the movie where Jim Carrey poops on his neighbor's lawn. This groundbreaking or ground-smearing moment comes early in the picture when Carrey's character, a Rhode Island state trooper named Charlie, flips out. Years before the lawn incident, Charlie's wife had left him for an aggressive African-American college professor slash chauffeur who, as it happens, was also a dwarf. But before she left, Charlie's wonderbread white wife had given birth to black triplets, who she leaves with Charlie. Charlie is very happy with his children, geniuses who speak in hip-hop street slang, but the cuckold still suffers from the ridicule of his neighbors in his small seaside community. Until one day, he just snaps. Charlie's persona disappears and is replaced by that of Hank, the last word in acting out. After Hank's tough guy personality takes over, the uniformed milquetoast goes on a comic rampage, almost drowning a bratty little girl, driving a bully's car into a barber shop, and fertilizing the aforementioned neighbor's lawn. Eventually, Charlie gets medication for schizophrenia, and that keeps Hank in check. Hank may be a snarling cauldron of hostility, but he's no paragon of judgment. He wants to fight more than Charlie does, but he's no better at it than Charlie is. And children in particular get his goat, as in this scene where Hank catches an 8-year-old boy staring at him over his milkshake.
What are you staring at? You want to start me up? Just open the choke and pull the cord, pal. I'm due for a side-sack event. You're dancing on the fault line.
Hey, what is your problem, pal?
I got no beef with you. This is between me and the kid.
Stop it!
He started it.
Sorry, I have to apologize for him. I mean, he suffers
from
this thing.
Stand right here for us.
He has a thing.
Let's
where
go.
He just...
Oh, poor baby. I should let his daddy fight his battles for him.
The woman you heard getting Hank out of trouble is Irene, who turns out to be the object of both Charlie and Hank's affections. Played by Renee Zellweger with a suitably unrelenting sense of outrage, Irene was arrested in Rhode Island on a trumped-up warrant issued by some corrupt New York cops. Not knowing the whole story, Charlie's superiors assign him to deliver Irene. It all gets needlessly complicated, but Charlie and Irene figure out something is wrong and hit the road. In the confusion, they leave Charlie's pills behind. As a result, Hank comes along as an unwanted and at first undetected third companion. It's all wildly funny at times, if always funny in the same taboo-shattering way, but for all its chutzpah, it's never offensive. The excess of effrontery and lack of offensiveness is typical of the film's directors, the brothers Peter and Bobby Farrelly, who, together with Mike Cerrone, also wrote Irene. There's an odd shrug-it-off quality to the brothers' work, whether here or in Something About Mary or Dumb and Dumber. First off, like a couple of impish kids, the Farrellys dare you to take offense at their wildly over-the-top conceptions. This movie virtually begins with a nunchuck-wielding black dwarf assaulting a cringing Charlie and accusing him of all manner of prejudice. The scene is so cartoonish and just so astonishingly unexpected that we never have a chance to get our sensibilities in shape to react. But most importantly, the Farrellys' hearts are always with the most abused and humiliated of their characters. Our point of identification isn't supposed to be Irene or any of the other normal people in the movie. We feel with, for, and through Carrie, and if we are continuously laughing at what happens to him, we are also at the same time rooting him on. Charlie may describe his problem as schizophrenia, but it's a lot less clinical and a lot more universal than that. Charlie is simply another man who can't live up to his own expectations of masculinity, and he is terrified of the rage and resentment that that failure has sparked. Hank, though, doesn't postpone gratification, but lunges for what he wants when he wants it. So when we laugh, it's not at Charlie's handicaps, but at his brilliant mad grab for freedom, wherever that takes him, even if it's just to his neighbor's lawn.
Henry Sheehan is the film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Milt Hinton, one of the most versatile and prolific bass players in jazz history, is celebrating his 90th birthday today. We'll close with one of the recordings he made with Cab Calloway in 1941. Happy birthday.
Do you come on like like Shorty, George, and me. Just feel some jive, we'll dig you out, you see.
Well, all right.
Are you ready?
Yes, we're ready, Joe.
Jumpin' steady.
Jumpin' steady, Joe.
You look solid, Joe. All I want to know, are you all right?
Yes, we're all right.
You can get it.
Can we get it?
If you said it.
Yes, we said it, Joe.
Come on, let me go. All I want to know, are you all right?
Yes, we're all right.
I'm like a tree, I'm all root. Hep to the jep, what it's all about. Stash like a towel, don't miss a stop. I dig my kicks from the groovy lot. Are you really?
Yes, we're really.
Trilly frilly.
Woo, woo, woo.
Woo, woo.
I don't go Navajo, come and let me know. Are you all right?
Yes, we're all right. Are you ready, Joe?
Yes, I'm ready, old man. Jumping with the jive, Jack.
That's all we want to know.
What do you
want
to know?
Are you all right?
Jump in the groove and go.
Yes, he's all right.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Island Records, presenting I Am Shelby Lynn, the new album available in stores, shelbylynne.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, available in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You do something to me.
On the next Fresh Air, the Sinatra Files, we talk with Tom and Phil Kuntz, editors of a new book on the FBI's nearly 1,300-page dossier on the singer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
To hypnotize me, let me live neath your spell. Do that voodoo, that's you.